Welcome to a special edition of The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. A rite of spring is upon us once again in Charm City. The Maryland Film Festival is an annual showcase of local, national, and international features, documentaries, shorts, and animations. And here to tour us through the offerings is Signal film critic Josh Slates, in studio with producer Aaron Hankin.
Josh Slates, you have emerged once again from another marathon prep session in your subterranean screening room deep beneath the earth. You are sun-deprived, you're squinting at the daylight, but you are edified and ready to walk us through the offerings at the upcoming 2015 Maryland Film Festival. For that, we thank you, and I say to you, sir, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again, as always.
First, the logistics, Josh. When and where is this thing happening this year?
It's May 6th through the 10th in downtown Baltimore and the Station North Arts District. They're adding some venues this year, including the Single Carrot Theater, but they are also retaining such wonderful screening facilities as the Walters Art Museum and the top-notch high-definition projection that they've installed at MICA and the Windup Space.
What are the big marquee screenings that are going to be bookending the festival this year?
Well, as always, they are opening the festival with a collection of short films from independent filmmakers. And the closing night movie, it's a documentary called The Wolf Pack. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance this year for Best American Documentary. And it's about a family of filmmakers living in New York's Lower East Side who are sort of learning their chops and cutting their teeth by remaking and restaging their own versions of popular Hollywood favorites.
Now, of course, one of the hottest tickets at the Maryland Film Festival every year is a special screening hosted by Baltimore movie legend and cinematic provocateur John Waters. This personal pick of his is always a film that's guaranteed to have some combination of shock value, controversy, and some cringe factor to it. And here with us this week to unveil his pick, the man himself, a man recently dubbed the People's Pervert, John Waters, welcome back to the
show. How are you? And I give you the Guardian as the one that called me the People's Pervert, which did make me laugh. I needed a new title this year. My other ones were tarnished.
Let's end the suspense, Mr. Waters. Your special screening pick for the 2015 Maryland Film Festival is?
Is Killer Joe, a movie that looks like the youngest, wildest filmmaker made it, and it was actually directed by William Friedkin in his 80s, I believe, right?
I don't think he's quite there yet.
All right, 70s. Okay.
William Friedkin is a name people might remember from The Exorcist.
Certainly many movies, really, like The
Sorcerer.
French Connection. Well, The Sorcerer I love, but people didn't remember that one. Mm-hmm. But they remember it later, maybe. But certainly he was known for more mainstream movies than this one. And this was his last movie, I think. Was it? Or I don't know.
It's his most recent film to date. Yeah. And wow, what a movie, huh?
And it's a shocker. And it only played for really a short time. It's really bizarre. It's like a hillbilly cartoon, melodrama, sexploitation movie. It's really fun.
It's never dull, and it's always entertaining if you have a strong stomach and you're an adventurous moviegoer.
Yeah, let's tell them who the cast is, because Gina Gershon really shocks me in this
Gina
movie.
Gershon
her performance
is
really amazing.
Not that she ever left.
Yeah.
And
but who else? Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, you didn't mention Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, he's the star of it. Yeah.
This was the beginning of a career resurgence for Matthew McConaughey.
With male nudity.
And no shortage of nudity from just about everyone else in the cast, too.
Yes.
But really, the hero of the film is a fried chicken leg that makes a pretty monumental turn in the closing reel, which I'm sure will make for a very animated post-screening discussion.
And it was also made by Brooke Yeaton, Pat Moran's son, who was the prop master on that movie and has worked on many movies with me and still works in the movie business all the time. So we have a local connection to the most shocking scene in the movie. And Brooke also was the owner of the dog that Divide did a scene with in Pink Flamingos.
Here is part of the cinematic trailer for Killer Joe. This will give audiences an idea of what's in store.
I need $6,000 or some guys are going to kill me.
Better get out of town quick.
You ever hear of Joe Cooper? He's a cop, a detective, actually. Got a little business on the side.
What you do?
He kills people. Mom's got a $50,000 life insurance policy. Killer Joe's a professional. He'll do this right.
This murder we're talking about. I ain't agreed to nothing.
I heard y'all talking about killing Mama. I think it's a good idea.
Well, there you go. My payment is $25,000 in cash. No exceptions. That's not our problem.
What is your problem?
We have a problem with the advance.
No exceptions.
Conversation is finished.
course, we never discussed the possibility of a retainer.
What do you mean? Hey, man, you talking about my sister?
Is that who she is?
Well, that's a high concept. That tells the whole plot, right?
You know, I never made the connection before, but I guess it is kind of like an early 1960s Russ Meyer Ruffy.
Like Lorna, that movie. Or
Mudhoney.
Mudhoney, yeah. Well, she's Mudhoney, and she's Mudhoney meets Baby Doll meets, what was that Christina Ricci made where she's chained to the radiator?
Oh, Black Snake Moan?
Yeah, she's like, yeah. So it's all those, if you know those genres, you might enjoy this movie. If you don't, you might not.
The voices here of John Waters and Signal film critic Josh Slates here on the tales of that trailer for Killer Joe, featuring Matthew McConaughey at his most charmingly creepy. John Waters, special pick for a screening at this year's Maryland Film Festival. And John Waters, we also want to give you a chance here on the program today to comment on another film that's going to be screening at the Maryland Film Festival this year. This one is a documentary. It's called Tab Hunter Confidential. It was made by filmmaker Jeffrey Schwartz. And just tell us who was and is Tab Hunter, and what does this movie explore?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you who Jeffrey Schwartz is, because he made the documentary I Am Divine. That also was at the Maryland Film Festival. So a lot of people, if you like that movie, I think you'll like this one too. Tab Hunter was a matinee at 50s pinup boy that was, Rock Hudson was first, he was second, kind of. They had the same agent, gave them both the ridiculous names. Tab was a golden boy, surfer boy, and every girl in the world was in love with him. And underneath it all, he was gay, and he reveals that way, way later in life when he wrote the book Tab Hunter Confidential. And even still, he's not too enthused about talking about it. He's old school, definitely old school. But this documentary, and I have seen it, has amazing footage of him when he was young and like fans and what he was like then and what he had to live with in this scariest closet of all, where everybody knew the studios, but you sort of made a deal where as long as you went out with the girls, they set you up. He had fake girlfriends, and it was all like that. The studio owned you. They owned your private life, too.
Well, it's interesting because I am of a generation who was sort of first introduced to Tab Hunter through, you know, your film Polyester and Paul Bartel's Lust in the Dust. So what's interesting about this documentary is it kind of helps to contextualize his status as a matinee idol from the 50s and how your films and his, you know, comedies in the 80s kind of subverted that image to ironic effect.
Yeah, he was a real Hollywood movie star, certainly. When I asked him to do it, it was, I guess, his career. I didn't realize it was probably at the lowest. He had just played like a Charles Manson type in a movie.
Sweet Kill.
And, yeah. And I offered him the most I had ever paid anybody to be in a movie. And I'm sure it was for him the lowest salary he had ever gotten to be in a movie. But he was a great sport about it. And he made that movie a hit, I believe. Odorama helped. But Tab was a great sport. And you can't imagine, even today, that this would have been such a shock that Tab Hunter actually kissed Divine in a movie. No one believed that he would have ever done this.
John Waters, you're obviously, of course, talking about your 1981 classic Polyester.
Yes, Polyester. Yes.
Well, I'm going to rewind back to this earlier era, though, the 1950s, when he was sort of the 1950s heartthrob. I'll play a clip here from the beginning of this documentary, Tab Hunter Confidential. You'll hear a kind of a montage of his 1950s glamour, and then you'll hear a current-day elder Tab Hunter reflecting back on that era.
This young fella you've been waiting for, ladies and gentlemen, Tab Hunter!
6 feet of rugged manhood to stir the heart of every woman.
Oh, my goodness, I'm flabbergasted!
Tab Hunter!
How do you shave, Tab?
With a Gillette Super Speed, of course.
Tab Hunter! You tell me where I could find Tab Hunter.
Well, you do pretty good.
Gee, thanks.
What do you like about Tab Hunter?
Well, quite a few things.
That clean-cut, unaffected Tab Hunter. That all-American born.
Shocking but true story of a young man who found himself overwhelmed by a strange compulsion.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and I've got a secret.
Well, I would never have talked about my personal life in the 1950s.
Something the matter, kid?
What?
Oh, no, not a thing.
I obviously was very closeted, and I'm sure it's a very difficult thing to think, what's the problem? But there was a problem. It's been very difficult for me my whole life talking about that side of me. For me to come out of myself like this and to share all of this is extremely difficult. I've never been as open as I am with you because it's been written about, and what the heck, you know, I'm an old man. I don't, you know, this is my life. Big deal.
It's not so shocking. I mean, Ricky Lake said to me once, what smart girl's first boyfriend wasn't gay?
That was, of course, Tab Hunter there in the documentary Tab Hunter Confidential. Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates, Baltimore legend John Waters in the studio with us. And John, tell us a little bit more about that later chapter of Tab Hunter's life that he shared with you when he came into the fold with you and Divine in 1981 in Polyester. What are some of your favorite memories of that time?
I remember how nervous Divine was because Divine, I only had him for a week. And I only afforded to get, so we shot the whole movie around him. Huh. And the first night he came, it was Cuddle's debutante party, and he had to slow dance with Divine in it. And Divine just couldn't believe that he was getting dragged to dance with Tab Hunter. Divine was the first time I ever saw him nervous. And Tab was such a pro and such a gentleman. And Tab was just having fun. He didn't seem to be upset by anything. We didn't discuss his sexuality at the time. We never talked about it. I think it was understood. You know, I think it was probably more shocking when he told me he was a Ronald Reagan supporter. So he liked making the movie so much that he made another movie with Divine afterwards that he wanted me to direct, but I didn't want to do because I didn't write it, and I've never directed a movie I didn't write. And Tab should have directed it. Paul Bartel directed it, and I love Paul. So Tab sort of made his own version of a movie with Divine. Divine loved making it. They shot it in Arizona, and Divine was great. It was a Western, obviously. So I think Tab had so much fun that it did give him a new life in a way.
John Waters talking about the late career cult comedy renaissance of Tab Hunter, the 1950s heartthrob who ended up later in life playing the love interest opposite Divine. Tab Hunter is the subject of the documentary Tab Hunter Confidential. It's screening at the upcoming Maryland Film Festival. And again, to recap, the movie that John Waters has picked this year for a special screening of his own, which he'll be hosting at the festival, Killer Joe, directed by William Friedkin and starring Matthew McConaughey. And John Waters, thank you, as always, for dropping by The Signal, and we'll look forward to seeing you around at the film festival.
All right. Thanks for having us.
You're tuned to The Signal on 88.1 WYPR. Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates as we look ahead to the 2015 Maryland Film Festival in Baltimore. It's coming up May 6th through the 10th. And, Josh, I want to move now to some short films from some local filmmakers that are going to be part of the festival's offerings. Karen Yuzinski has a short in the festival. It's titled After Hours 2013-14. And what do you want to tell us about this film?
It's an experimental mixed media exploration or meditation, if you will, on the themes of senseless violence, cultural observation, and hypnotism, in Karen's own words. It's also featuring some really wild original puppet animation that sort of represents the film's tentative view of humanity and its goodness. It's a one-of-a-kind viewing experience, and it's playing in the Avant-Garde Shorts program.
Also on the roster this year, a short by local filmmaker Matthew Bowden called Spare Rooms.
Yeah, it's a 1985 period piece about a same-sex family and sort of the elaborate subterfuge that comes into play when their young son has his friend over for a sleepover, and they have to present the illusion of a cookie-cutter nuclear American family.
And we actually have an extended interview with Matt Bowden coming up in the final segment of our special Maryland Film Festival preview program this hour, so stay tuned for that. And one more notable short film to mention here, an offering from Baltimore's rising star filmmaker Matt Porterfield. He's actually kind of a full-on risen star at this point. His feature-length movies Putty Hill and I Used to Be Darker have screened all over the place, from Sundance to South by Southwest to the Whitney Biennial to the Berlin Film Festival, and he has kindly agreed to drop in here at the studios this week for our festival preview. And Matt Porterfield, good to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here, Aaron. Hi, Josh. Nice to see you.
Matt, your new film is a short. It's about a half hour long. It's titled Take What You Can Carry. And this is a departure for you, most notably, in that it's not set in Baltimore.
Yes, I made this film in Berlin, in Germany. I had the idea of going, but I didn't know what I was going to do when I arrived. So it was largely improvisational and really collaborative.
To that end, let me ask you to tell the story that unfolds in this film. Talk about who our protagonist is, this young woman, Lily, and what's going on in her life.
So, yeah, she's living in Berlin for an indeterminate amount of time. She's a North American artist, actor, who's just kind of figuring out her rules of engagement with the world, I suppose. Structurally, I kind of think about it as a triptych, in that it has like these three distinct 10-minute sections that are all set in these interior spaces that she occupies. I was inspired by a text by Georges Perec, a collection called Species of Spaces, which is a meditation on both the kind of like micro and the macro, the intimate, the private, and the public spaces that we occupy. So that was sort of a departing point for me, point of departure, I suppose.
You mentioned a triptych, and so I guess what I'll be playing here is from the first panel of that triptych. This is a clip from the beginning of the film, and there really isn't much in the way of dialogue in this film, actually. You could probably fit the whole script on like a page or two, but this is a little moment early on in the film when Lily comes down the hall into the kitchen of an apartment where she's staying, and she sits down at the table with a guy. He's plucking an acoustic guitar, and these two appear to have an affectionate but perhaps not that stable relationship going on.
So you had fun last night?
It's okay. How about you?
Yeah, cool. You come and go as you please.
What do you mean?
Nothing. I'm happy when you're here.
I'm happy when I'm here too.
A scene from the beginning of Matt Porterfield's short film, Take What You Can Carry. And Matt, you really seem to leave a lot to your viewers' interpretations here. Like for every word said in this film, it seems there's much more left unspoken, and we're kind of left to connect the dots in our own way.
I guess I sort of make films for the kind of audience that I imagine myself to be. You know, I like to be kind of figuring things out. You know, I like to meet characters on screen like I might meet them in life.
And what's sort of interesting about the movie is that you are sort of filming in this sort of brand new milieu for you in Berlin. And the movie, really the setting is Lily's personal headspace. It's sort of her own sort of microcosm of solitude, perhaps, in comparison to the macrocosm of this kind of new world that she's inhabiting.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The film takes place mostly in interior spaces. You know, the sort of city of Berlin kind of exists in the collective imagination. And there's a key correspondence in the film, which is a correspondence that she keeps with her grandmother. She receives a letter from her grandmother in the beginning, and then she writes one in return. And those were letters that my grandmother, Marie Collins, wrote to me this past summer. Well, one she wrote me and one I wrote her. And I like the fact that the most clear line of communication is happening with somebody out of frame that we never meet.
Matt Porterfield, his latest film is a short titled Take What You Can Carry, and it's going to screen at the upcoming 2015 Maryland Film Festival. And Matt, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure talking to both of you.
You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR in Baltimore. Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates, and our 2015 Maryland Film Festival preview continues right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined by Signal film critic Josh Slates. We've heard so far this hour from Baltimore film luminaries John Waters and Matt Porterfield. We're going to be connecting with some other national and international filmmakers by phone in just a few minutes. But first, Josh, a few words about some standout documentaries. This one looks fantastic. It's called Breaking a Monster.
Yeah, it focuses on a trio of teenage speed metal rock stars from Brooklyn, New York, in a band called Unlocking the Truth. They are courted, if you will, by a veteran music producer named Alan Sachs, who was responsible for bringing the Jonas Brothers to bedroom walls everywhere. And it sort of shows how these kids, who were sort of discovered for being fresh, unlikely, you know, speed metal stars.
Real iconoclasts, because they're 13 years old and they're African-American.
and really sort of at a loss when it comes to, you know, finding a place for themselves in the music industry. You see them in these marketing sessions with record label, brand specialists, and you see them begin to wonder, you know, was it worth it? They're kind of suspicious at this process, which is sort of seeking to turn them into everything that they were rebelling against as artists.
And again, the title of that film, Breaking a Monster. Another documentary I want to focus on with you, Josh, is called Sailing a Sinking Sea. This is a documentary slash art film, I guess you could say, about this remote Southeast Asian group of people called the Moken. And these people literally live three-fourths of their lives on the water in these little thatched roof homemade boats.
Yeah, it's sort of an ethnographic fantasia if you think about these films that document faraway cultures. You know, the first thing that might come to mind is the omniscient narration. There is some highly expressive, dexterous underwater cinematography in this film. It's gorgeous to look at. It's the sort of film that just completely immerses you. And it's really unlike anything I've seen in a long time.
And Josh, we are about to be joined on the line by the filmmaker, Olivia Wyatt. But first, let me just play this short clip from the film. This is a woman explaining how she and her husband live together with their children on a homemade boat. She says she and her husband have been together since they were young, that they'll be together till they're old, and that they help each other survive. I should say, at this point, you've heard this splash. This man has casually jumped off his boat into the sea, and now we go underwater with him. And what we're seeing is he's got a spear in his hand, and there's this technicolored coral bed, and there's schools of fish swimming everywhere. He doesn't have a snorkel, no mask, nothing like that. He's just there with all of this, and then he sees this fish that he wants to target with his spear, and then he spears it. And then, just as completely casually, he just floats back up to the surface of the water with it. Every second of this film is just mesmerizing. And I'm happy to say that we've got filmmaker Olivia Wyatt on the phone with us now. Olivia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell us the story of the time you spent with these people, the Moken. Am I saying that correctly?
That is correct.
How did this amazing film happen?
So I first read about the Moken after the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004, and I was fascinated by them because every single Moken survived the tsunami. And I just continued to read about them throughout the years, and I saw that their population was on a decline. And I wanted to go over and make a film that preserved their community as much as I could and their traditions before, you know, they completely got engulfed by modernity. I ended up living with a Moken grandmother for about 3 weeks, and then started going to all these different islands from there.
Talk about the cosmology of these people, the religious beliefs, and how just how much these beliefs have sprung out of their way of life, the fact that they live literally on the water in boats.
Right, so much of their cosmology involves the sea, and there are a lot of spirits that they speak of that live in the sea that are worshipped. And in fact, for them, there was one giant wave, like the first tsunami. That's how the world started. It came and it created one little island, and there were two people, and they had a dog and a cat, and then they gave birth to all these different nations.
This film is so poetic and so surreal at points. It's a really beautiful antidote to some of the more formulaic, like, National Geographic type ethnography films out there. I mean, you probably could have made one of those more cookie cutter formatted documentaries, and who knows, gotten it on the National Geographic channel. But I sense that's sort of the opposite of what you wanted to accomplish here artistically.
It is. You know, I mean, I think everybody's making films in that style, and I'm not a fan of talking heads, and I don't want to interject my voice at all. I want the community to speak for itself. So I just have the Moken community, 15 members of the Moken community, explaining who they are and what they do and what their beliefs are.
Can you talk a moment about how you captured, on a technical level, some of just the stunning underwater footage that comprises most of the film?
I actually shot this film with one other person. I was in Thailand for half the time alone, and then a friend came over, and we shot a lot of the underwater and villages together. And we had a GoPro, a Umig Nautico, which is this old Austrian Super 8 camera that's specifically made for underwater shooting, and also a Canon G1X, which is just a little Canon that has a great housing. And with the GoPro, I would do things, you know, like attach it to the spears facing in different directions while the men were fishing. And, you know, I just tried to get as creative as I could. Shooting underwater was not easy for me. I mean, I've been a certified scuba diver for 7 years, but it's a whole different world when you're trying to shoot in strong currents.
Under presumably very rugged conditions, and I think you got a lot of amazing footage, and I think you truly went where no documentary filmmaker has gone before.
Oh, thank you.
Filmmaker Olivia Wyatt, her ethnographic portrait of the Moken people of Southeast Asia is titled Sailing a Sinking Sea. It's going to be screening at the upcoming Maryland Film Festival, and Olivia Wyatt, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
You're tuned to The Signal. Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates in advance of the upcoming Maryland Film Festival. And Josh, I want to move now to a feature-length film. I'm not sure whether or not to call this a comedy or a drama. It is by director Allison Bagnell, and it's called Funny Bunny.
Yeah, it's a film starring Kentucker Audley, who audiences will recognize from past Maryland Film Festival titles such as Amy Simons' Sun Don't Shine. He stars as Gene, a childhood obesity activist who is reeling from an acrimonious divorce. And down on his luck, he befriends a wealthy but emotionally stunted man-child, played by Ollie Alexander, who is obsessed with a vegan webcam personality, memorably immortalized by Joslyn Jensen. And what ensues is sort of an unusual love triangle that leads them down a transformative yet potentially tragic path when they become embroiled with a group of militant animal rights activists.
Expertly synopsized. Josh, yeah. You hear director Allison Bagnell agreeing with me. She's on the phone with us. And Allison, I want to turn to you in just a moment. But first, let me set us up with a clip from the film. At the beginning of our story, we meet this guy, Gene. He seems kind of like a well-intentioned but a little bit awkward of a fellow. He's going door to door, as Josh mentioned, trying to raise awareness about childhood obesity. And he seems pretty accustomed to rejection. Here's an example of how things go for him.
Hello. Good day, sir. My name is Gene. I'm in your area today talking about the childhood obesity epidemic. Did you know that childhood obesity has quadrupled in the last 40 years? The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has predicted that 1 in 3 children born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes.
Okay, listen, just stop for a second. Just, you've got 10 seconds, okay? Because I just got home.
Childhood obesity is a terrible, terrible affliction. 1 in 3 children born in the year 2000, according to the CDC, the United States government will be...
Time's up.
Okay. That didn't seem like 10 seconds.
Yeah, well, you're on my porch, so I decide what 10 seconds is, okay?
It's a different 10 seconds?
Yeah, it is. So
this is the kind of social interaction that Gene seems to be quite used to, and then director Allison Bagnell, Gene knocks on the door of a mansion and meets this very unlikely homeowner, this effete young man-child. He introduces himself by a nickname that I'm not sure we can say on public radio. It refers to a woman's mammary gland. Let's refer to him as T. And this is where our story really kicks in. Director Allison Bagnell, you're on the line with us. Welcome to the program, first of all.
Very happy to be coming to Baltimore again.
And Allison, the tone of this movie is a real enigma. It wavers back and forth, it seems to me, between humor and melancholy, and it creates this really off-kilter feeling. Would you call this a comedy?
Well, I call it a serious comedy, actually, because I like movies that are both funny and dramatic at the same time, and I think that the humor heightens the poignancy of the story and vice versa. So I like movies that sort of go between, you know, drama and comedy.
And as far as the characters in this film, they all seem to have somehow failed to grow up in one way or another. They're like children in grown-up bodies. Is that fair to say? What is going on with this theme that interests you as a filmmaker?
I'm interested in people who are sort of, have had traumatic upbringings. Well, one of them is a product of maternal neglect, and they've all been a bit abused or neglected in various ways. And so I'm just interested in people who haven't developed properly because of some traumatic circumstance.
What I thought was really interesting about the movie is how all of the characters are in sort of a process of disassociating themselves from their personal reality, hiding from the reality of a dissolving marriage, or in hiding from a traumatic family history and leading an agrarian lifestyle on a farm, and yet paradoxically communicating with the world through 21st century webcam technology.
Yes.
Was this a product of just sort of bringing all of these characters together in your narrative?
It's interesting that you point out this disassociation. I think that's a common survival tactic of for a lot of people who have been through hard experiences. It can be painful to sort of feel the pain. And so, you know, people who've been through, who have a traumatic past, will often find things to focus on or obsess about, if you will, in order to not have to, you know, feel those feelings. So, you know, I think it's a common coping mechanism for traumatized people. So, yeah, that's pretty common. I mean, my mom's a therapist, and I realized that I, like, would have been a therapist, except I didn't really want to be one, because I saw her getting pretty depressed and sad from a lot of the stories she would hear every day. And anyway, and I think that the films I make are sort of like therapy films.
Allison Bagnell is the director of Funny Bunny. It's screening at the upcoming Maryland Film Festival. And Allison, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thank you for speaking to me. I'm so excited to be coming.
You're tuned to The Signal. Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates. And Josh, we move now to a very dark comedy called Stinking Heaven by director Nathan Silver. This is a movie about a group of pretty dysfunctional folks. They all live together in a communal home for sober living in New Jersey. This film is set in 1990, and a new arrival shows up on the scene there and very thoroughly disrupts this ecosystem of this isolated little cult. Nathan Silver, the director, joins us now on the line from his home in New York City. And Nathan, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
Nathan, do you have some kind of personal familiarity with this kind of a commune or cult or halfway house kind of communal life?
Yes. My uncles and aunts all were part of ashrams and for a good chunk of their adulthood. So, and then my cousins grew up on ashrams in upstate New York and in Vermont.
It's really interesting. One of the notes I wrote to myself while I was watching this film was, we try to make nice places for ourselves, and then we ruin them by being there.
That's beautiful. I love that.
This movie feels like a satire in a way of this idealism of commune people. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes, yes. I think that whenever I would go and visit my family in upstate New York, I always felt like there were beautiful ideas that caused this to come about, and those ideas have evaporated into, you know, just this painful way to live. I don't know if it's healthy. I mean, it's all families are unhealthy in their own ways, right? But I think a commune is just is not necessarily the way to go.
Well, it's just a much bigger family, so it can be
much
more unhealthy, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, it's more of a mess.
Yeah. I want to play a clip here. This is from late in the film. This is once things have sort of imploded and, you know, relapses and love triangles have pretty well made everyone in this home absolutely hate each other. This is at a group session that they have in their living room. And one of the guys is trying to get the rest of the group to sing along with him, to sing this sort of like life-affirming theme song that they have together. And I think from an audio perspective, this is just a great representation of the utter failure of the whole scenario at this point.
Just waste of my time, man. It's f***ing, I could go play music by myself. I don't need to be in a f***ing circle of clowns. If you're not going to play, then what's the f***ing point?
Just f***ing play, man.
Love never ends. Love can end.
Hey, now!
No. Love can end. So again.
All right, all right. going. There's a group sing along, or is this a group sing along?
Let's all sing.
I'm singing.
You weren't singing.
Good.
Love never ends. Love descends. Show love again. You go, you're never alone. Wherever you go, you're always at home.
A group sing-along, or rather a failed attempt at one, late in Stinking Heaven, a film by Nathan Silver. And I wanted to ask, you know, because the film is set in the early 90s and you emulate the consumer-grade digital video technology of that era to striking effect, you know, how did you approach the necessity of working in that medium and yet still achieving just a wonderful sense of visual expressionism in the cinematography?
Well, I think the camera itself immediately distorts reality, which HD obviously doesn't do. So we had this broadcast video camera from the late 70s, early 80s, and some of the documentaries I was watching were shot on a similar camera. So I knew I wanted something where, you know, it has ghosting, and when you go across certain sources of light, weird colors will appear. So it immediately has this distortion that I love. I adore it.
Nathan Silver is the director of Stinking Heaven. It is set to screen at the upcoming Maryland Film Festival. And Nathan, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates as we continue our preview of the 2015 Maryland Film Festival. And next on the line with us is Todd Rohal, director of an unruly and unlikely movie sequel. Todd Rohal, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And you're joining us here on the phone from Austin, and we're going to take a few minutes with you, Todd, to talk about your movie, Uncle Kent 2. This is an indie film here about itself, essentially a sequel that is about the perils and pitfalls of making a sequel. How do you describe the actual story of this film to people?
It's a sequel based on a movie that no one ever saw, so it's something that we intended to make where no one would have ever seen the original, which is pretty much how I feel about going to any sequel nowadays anyway. But it's based on an actual movie called Uncle Kent that Joe Swanberg made in 2011, and the star of it, Ken Osborne, actually did want to make it. It is based in truth, wanted to make a sequel to it, and it just wasn't coming together. So I stepped in, and in the actual movie, it takes a shift and starts to turn into a very different thing as a different director takes over the movie for Kent.
And we have a clip right here from the beginning of the film, which was actually directed by Joe Swanberg, which sort of sets up the whole enterprise and sort of, you know, passes the torch to a new generation of Uncle Kent sequel makers.
Yes, this is Kent, the hero of the first movie. He's ridden his bicycle to a dinner party where Joe Swanberg, the director of the original movie, is hanging out. They're out on this balcony, and Kent, he makes his pitch. And his director basically interrupts him at one point and says,
I mean, I don't want to be a d***, but, like, I hate sequels, man. Like, I hate the current culture that we live in where, like, when I go to the movie theater, all, like, my only options are, like, sequels to movies, reboots
those,
of movies, franchises of movies.
That's like Star Trek. Or,
I know, but making making a sequel to an independent film is even worse, man. That's supposed to be... That's the counterculture.
Hello? 911? Yeah, you can stop the search. I found him. The only guy on the planet who doesn't like Godfather Part 2.
No, I'm not.
Huh? Yeah, no, he's right here.
I mean...
What's that? Gremlins 2? Do you like Gremlins 2?
What does that
no,
have to
he
do
doesn't like, he doesn't like any sequels.
I don't like any
no
sequels.
No sequels.
I just don't think I want to do it.
Okay.
Kent Osborne getting thoroughly shut down there at a dinner party by the director of his first movie in that clip from Uncle Kent 2. The sequel. And director Todd Rohal, who we have on the phone, we should probably say a few words about maybe the style and general arc of the story of the original Uncle Kent, just so we can sort of compare and contrast with what you have done in the sequel.
Well, sure. The original Uncle Kent I only saw once at Sundance. I was not deep into research on it, but I saw it once and enjoyed it because I'm a big fan of Kent's work, and I think he's a very funny guy. And they shot it in 11 days for about $2,000. It was just done so low. I mean, it was just Kent and director Joe Swanberg in a room with no camera operator. I mean, they were just doing it bare bones. very small. And then I felt like this movie should get, and the sequel should get progressively bigger as it goes, or feeling like it's getting into a bigger production, you know, like into, as we sort of dive into Kent's head, we sort of become the movie he dreams of it becoming.
Right. In your sequel, Todd Rohal, our protagonist, Kent, he arrives at a comic convention in, where, San Diego?
Yes, San Diego. Comic-Con.
And at this point, the film takes this sharp right turn into almost like a psychedelic, surrealist, sci-fi genre. What was it like for you guys to sort of create these, you know, Matrix-like altered reality scenes?
I guess we were just kind of goofing around coming up with stuff that felt funny to us. I mean, like, you know, it was, there were no rules, you know, with it. So it sort of, it led us, you know, to the point as we were writing it and putting it together that it's just like, I think we've allowed ourselves the liberty to create our own world here, and there's no logic. And, you know, for me, that's the most exciting thing about movies, when it does something unexpected and lives by its own rules, and that's kind of where we wanted to take it. And, yeah, I guess a man losing his mind is the best place to kind of allow that to happen.
Todd Rohal is the director of Uncle Kent 2, the sequel to Uncle Kent. He joins us here from Austin by phone. Thanks for being with us, Todd. Be well.
Thank you so much.
And that's going to pretty much wrap things up for our 2015 Maryland Film Festival preview. A couple of other thank yous I want to make sure we put out there. Thank you to Jed Dietz, Eric Allen Hatch, Scott Braid, Melina Giorgi, Rain Alexander, and most especially all the volunteers at the Maryland Film Festival. And last but not least, Signal film critic Josh Slates. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
You're very welcome, but my genuine thanks to you, Aaron. I really appreciate it.
The Maryland Film Festival runs from May 6th through the 10th, and details are online at mdfilmfest.com. After the break, filmmaker Matt Bowden on his story about growing up in the Reagan-era Midwest in a house with a secret. Stay with us. Welcome back to a special edition of The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. The key to a good lie is in its detail. That's a quote from Spare Rooms, a film by Baltimore-based writer and director Matthew Bowden. The film tells a family fiction that closely resembles Bowden's own childhood, growing up in a rural same-sex household in the 1980s. Spare Rooms will be screening this week as part of the Maryland Film Festival. Matthew Bowden and film producer Joe Trupea spoke to The Signal's Lisa Morgan about the making of Spare Rooms, a family fiction.
The premise is pretty simple. It's 1985, it's the rural Midwest, and a same-sex family's teenage son invites a friend to stay overnight, and the family bends over backwards to appear in the closet, and everything just goes absolutely wrong. And the way that the son has to keep his family's secret intact and you know, what he has to do that, I think is something that it's the type of subterfuge that most people who are on the outside looking in have had to go through before.
And of course, the secret is that
his mom's a lesbian. When you go into the world of the rural Midwest in 1985, it's the height of the Reagan era, and there is no support structure. And, you know, I mean, I think Spare Rooms for me was in some ways a reaction to seeing contemporary films dealing with LGBT issues where it was as if this wasn't an issue anymore. And so I wanted to take it back just a little bit to a place where you don't have that. And what do you do? What do you do when you have to lie in that situation and there's no place else to go?
Well, and the spare room in the title refers to the grand plan of the fiction.
Sure.
The maintenance of this room that's supposed to be one of the women's bedrooms.
And that was something that when I started talking with folks within the LGBT community about this, folks who were older, who were from that time period, it opened up a whole other level of conversation because it was something that a lot of folks had forgotten about. In fact, there was one couple that I was talking with. They were like, oh, my God, Megan, do you remember when we had the spare bedroom? And if you had a family, and if you were trying to maintain that fiction, that was a key part of your physical life. You made sure that wherever you moved, you had that extra room so that you could maintain the fiction when people came to visit. And that's something that I think has been lost.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how even that little detail in 30, 20 years has changed. It's no longer expected that you're going to have this spare room if you're trying to lead a respectable life and you're trying to live a life in the closet, you know, in these areas where it's not necessarily, you know, where it's frowned upon.
Attitudes now have changed. I, you know, my daughter goes to school with, it's become, the kids are not even impressed when two moms show up for, you know, a pageant or something, or two dads show up. It's just part of, you know, they just talk about it like it's just a normal thing.
And I really wanted to put a spotlight on a time period where it wasn't necessarily life or death, but it was certainly an issue. You could lose your job over it. You could still lose your job over it. I wanted to bring it back to a point where this didn't just happen. These parents didn't just come out of the woodwork after Melissa Etheridge. You know,
right.
These folks have been around forever. And so I wanted to walk it back a little bit, because right now our narrative has jumped to Modern Family and to all of these other things where it's not a thing. I wanted to back it up a little bit and say, you know what? Even though you're comfortable with it where you are, I can take you to places in this country where that is not the case. And it is still very much, in some ways, what you would have found at this time period in 1985. So let's step back and take an assessment of where we are.
Well, you've brought together sort of a super group of people to put this project together. And I'd love to hear how you came to work with Joe and the other people who are involved in the project. Joe, how did you come to this project?
I suppose I met Matt at last year's Maryland Film Festival. And at some point, Matt said, I think I have a script I'd like you to look at and see if you're interested in it. And the next thing you know, all my friends were all working on this project together.
I'm interested about the casting process, because that must have been kind of fun, casting your life, you know? Who gets a chance to do that? You hear people joke about, like, well, I'd like so-and-so to play me in the movie, but, you know, you literally had to do that. Was that a kind of a fun process?
It was fun. It was also a matter of, you know, learning how to distance yourself from that. Because, I mean, you know, you can say you're telling your own story, but you need to give an actor room to make it their own. You can't, you know, turn it into, you know, oh, I did this, you do this. You can't do that. So that was certainly a learning experience for me. It was learning how to put that space between it and let actors kind of take it where they wanted to go. So, you know, the casting process, we had about maybe 35 people audition for the various roles.
Wow.
And it was really, I mean, you know, there were a lot of great actors who came in. I was really amazed.
That was the really fun part of the process for me, because I've never really, I've been on casting calls, but I've never sat in one from this angle.
Yeah.
And you find yourself rooting for certain, for everyone
sure.
in a way.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's like playing music. You sort of know when, you know, you've got someone that works. It's
right
like.
Thing.
Yeah, there were a few, I mean, folks who came in who, you know, knew right away. Others, I had to kind of sleep on it. And to be honest, I mean, I could have gone a lot of different ways with this. I mean, ultimately, you know, you look for folks who seem like they're going to work with each other very well, and you're looking for folks who can, within a very short period of time, make a role their own. When I found somebody who could do something with an element that I'd been living with for years and take it someplace else within 2 or 3 seconds, that was when I knew I had something good. And, you know, that really was just, you know, again, letting other people take it and go where they want to with it. In a lot of ways, that was very liberating for me, both as a writer and as a director.
We're sisters. Sisters. Mm-hmm. Don't worry, babe. We're covered.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Bowden and Joe Tropea talking with Lisa Morgan about their film Spare Rooms. It'll be screening at the upcoming Maryland Film Festival. Details are online at mdfilmfest.com. And that's going to wrap things up for this special edition of The Signal. You can find on-demand audio and podcasts of the program at wypr.org/program/signal. That's also where you can reach us with any thoughts and questions you might have about the show. The Signal is an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. Our theme music comes to us from Wendell Patrick, and the program is produced by Lisa Morgan and Aaron Hinken. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Andy Beanstock. Thanks for listening.